Well, we're all ready to do the final section and then we'll be done for today. What I want to talk about next is overloading. That is something, as I said, does occur in languages and is in fact in CSX. And it's probably one of the more complex things. What I'll recommend is with respect to overloading, when you implement it, first do method declarations and calls without overloading, and then add that in as an extension once the basic is working. Overloading exists because we like to have multiple declarations that are similar in concept, but differ typically in the number or type of parameters. So here's an example that represents two variations on sum. The more obvious one takes two explicit parameters, but the alternative is to have a parameter from the class object itself. So one of these oddities, when you have binary operators in object-oriented languages, oftentimes they define binary operators as if they were unary, with one of the data values being obtained from the object itself. Remember that we can think of sum as being a member of the class. And because sum is a member of a class, it has access to data that's private to a particular class object. So it's not uncommon to see two alternative definitions. One is the one that notice this is defined as static. And it's defined as static because it completely ignores the local data inside of an object. This is the way almost all of us who learn programming in the last 10 or 20 years learned how to do binary operations. You take two parameters and use them both at equal level. But object-oriented languages also allow, as I said, a binary operation like sum that takes one explicit parameter and one implicit, that being the actual data in the object from which you're executing that particular member. So sometimes you want to have both variations available, and to be sensible, you want to give it the same name, in this case sum. So what we have a difference here is the number of arguments. And as you might imagine, when we do a call, we count the number of explicit parameters and decide is it the first or the second definition that we want to have. What we're going to have to do when we handle overloading is say now when we do a declaration, it won't have one definition, it'll have multiple definitions. And if you think about it, if you ever look at a dictionary, that's true almost all the time. And anybody who learns English as a non-first language must be driven crazy by all the variations English has. For example, it has words that have different meanings, but exactly the same spelling. Sometimes they have the same spelling, but different pronunciations. So I can lead, or I can have a bar of lead. And the past tense of lead is lead, but it's not spelled the same as the other lead. So things of that sort. But basically what is similar to the way we'll handle it and the way a dictionary handles it is you'll have one entry, the name of a method, and you'll have a list of alternatives. And you're going to say, which of these alternatives is appropriate? And again, when you're learning new words out of a dictionary, it's a similar sort of thing. You'll go down and look at a list of various definitions and try to figure out which one is appropriate in the context at hand. So in this case, our rules are a little simpler because exactly one call will match based on the number or type of parameters. So if, for example, I saw something like this, I would have two definitions of sum, as I illustrated earlier, and I would know which, or perhaps neither, is appropriate. But they both can't be appropriate because we know at the time when the definition was processed that each one differed in some substantial way. Namely, it had a different number of arguments, or in some position, it had a different type of arguments. So it would go back and say, okay, sum, clearly there's only one parameter. So it goes back and says, here's a definition which has two parameters. Nice try, but this one can't be it. It says, here's one that has one parameter. That's potentially it. Well, now knowing that this is the only alternative left, do the usual checking. It has to have the right number, has the right number and the right type. So here's, it takes an integer parameter, and 10, of course, is an integer literal. So it says, of those two definitions, clearly the second one is the one I want, and you transparently use it without any complaint or without any fancy processing. A few languages go even further and allow you to differentiate based not on the number or type of parameters, but on the return value. That's something that's fallen into some disrepute because it can be very complex. Because what happens is if you look at the result type, you say in context, would the entire expression containing that call be type correct or type incorrect? And that's sometimes a difficult thing to do. In fact, it turns out it was so nasty that for a while nobody quite knew how to do it. And then an old classmate of mine, a guy named Ted Baker, came up with an algorithm. But he came up with something very clever and something I'll recommend to you if you ever invent something that you think people might want to know about. And namely is don't give it a good name. He did not give it a good name, so it became Baker's algorithm. And in the literature, you know, he's years ago, so, you know, Baker's algorithm is something that we could use to figure that out. Not Baker like Bread Baker, but Baker for a man whose last name was Baker. And it turns out that always a good idea that don't give it a name and your name might be associated with it. If it's a bad algorithm, that's a bad idea. So to this day, I saw him years ago. He said he gets calls about Baker's algorithm and he's long since gone past it. He doesn't even want to hear about it, but people know it as Baker's algorithm. Overloading is kind of cool, but the question is, do you want to carry it to the next step? Some languages have where you overload not just identifier names, but you can overload operators. Java has done a little bit of that, but it does not allow user specification in the sense that in Java, plus is used for arithmetic plus, either integers or floats, but it's also used for string concatenation. And that kind of makes sense. You can think of adding two strings together as smashing them together into one composite string, the way two small numbers added together form a bigger number. So in language like C++ and, again, C-sharp experts, does C-sharp allow overloading of operators?
Yes.
And there's some talk about Java doing it, but I don't think it's been pushed through yet. So you can kind of give your vote and say whether you like it or not. But what happens in this particular case is I can take an existing operator. Now, there are caveats. You're not allowed to create new operators. Some languages have even gone as far as doing that. And you're not allowed to change the properties of an operator. So if it's left associative, it's still left associative. If it has lesser precedence than multiplication, it still does. So that means the grouping together and the parsing is unchanged. But what will happen is whenever you see an operator like plus, as far as the symbol table is concerned, that's just an abbreviation, a synonym, if you would, for something called operator plus. Notice that's something that a user may not normally define except on a limited basis for an existing operator and this kind of semi-reserved word operator. It's a reserved prefix followed by a symbol that's a legitimate standard operator. And what you're able to do then is go ahead and declare an operator. And again, it's this odd form I talked about earlier where plus is normally binary, but it takes only one parameter. And the reason for it is this is declared as a member of a class where the left operand is already in the object. So in this case, it'd be the complex number that is represented by the real and imaginary part implemented as floating point numbers. So the cool part about this is that you can go ahead and generate a new class object and have operators operate on new objects pretty much like they did on previously existing objects. So in this sort of thing, let's first look at how it's called. Do I have an example of how it's called? Let's go back and show you how it's called. So in this sort of thing, if I had complex C and D, I could simply say C plus D and actually invoke this operation. What would happen is it would say that's a binary operator, and what it's going to happen is since C and D are complex, the usual pre-declared plus obviously is not applicable. So it's not automatically an error. Rather, it says go into C and see if in its definition it has a definition of the operator plus. It may have many, in fact, so you can have mixed mode. I could have a complex added to an integer or a complex added to a float as an extension beyond what I currently have. So it says, do I have a single operand of type complex? And the answer is I do. And therefore, you execute this code, which executes a complex addition by adding the real parts and the imaginary parts and returning a new class object that represents it. So this is kind of an interesting sort of thing. And again, C++ guys, is this something that, and C#, is this something that's used routinely or only on occasion? On occasionally. It's a cool sort of thing. But again, it's like any good idea, people oftentimes push it a little too far. And there exist some languages where you can actually create, at the scanner level, new operators with new symbols. For example, there are some languages where I can create a new operator, and I don't even know how to pronounce it, because it is just newly created, that acts as that. And does anybody guess what this thing is doing? It's not a greater than, it's not a less than, it's not a subtraction, it's what? Say it louder. No, it's not bad. Actually, think of this not as minus sign. Think of it as like kind of a double-ended arrow. Swapping. And you think about it, swapping is just one of those things that occasionally it's cool to do. And swapping is normally nasty because you got to create this intermediate value, right? You got to have a new holder, copy the old value, put the new value into the old value, and then the copied value into what you just copied from. And it's just dirty enough that sometimes people say, blah, I hate this. And this is a case where it's not standardized, but it'd be a cool thing. But as you imagine, you can carry it further and further. And this sort of thing, when you put your mind in the right direction, it kind of looks like swapping, and it's a natural thing. But as somebody was saying, you could also think of it as having something to do with subtraction and comparison or something. So it's not there. So languages even carry it further. I think user-defined operators is probably more trouble than it's worth. Although, as scientists, it's fun to play with it and, you know, create a monster and then say, not my fault. But overloaded operators are something that do exist, and I think there is a place for them. And I'm not sure, has anybody seen the new, Java 8 does not have overloaded operators, right? I haven't seen it. Does anybody know if Java 9 is thinking about it? But anyway, to keep your heads up, you know, situation there. But the thing about this is not all that much harder to implement than ordinary operators. So think of this as just a funny name for a method. Instead of calling it F or ABS or anything else, I have a name that has identifiers and letters, and now I'm allowed to have special operator symbols with a very limited range of variety. In this particular case, the way I implement this is exactly the same way, and in terms of the symbol table, and when I see something like C plus D, I first go ahead and say, check the types. If these are not primitive types, this cannot be the pre-declared plus that exists in the language from day one. It's got to be some user definition. And what happens is, therefore, check the left operand and look up not plus, but operator plus in the symbol table. Because plus by itself does not, you know, is not an identifier, it's valid, but operator plus is allowed. And look it up, and then from then on, it's just like going ahead and doing an ordinary method call. So it looks, you know, like it's be kind of complex to do, but it's really not. It turns out with very minor changes, you can add it to the language if you want it. And I think particularly if you're doing types that have some notion of using operators like comparison or addition or so on, it's a nice ability to be able to do that. And in fact, C++, you can also, I believe, overload the assignment operator. And I know people have thought about that, but overloading the assignment operator is awfully powerful and awfully dangerous. One of the things that's lacking in C and original C++ is garbage collection. I'll be talking about garbage collection. And one of the ways that some C++ programs sneak garbage collection in the back door is they overload the assignment operator to do the steps that a garbage collector has to do its job invisibly. So the upside is, hey, I now got garbage collection in my language. The downside is every assignment is now way slower than it used to be, because typically an assignment, is, as you probably would guess, is typically done by moving a value from one memory location to another. That's a couple, three instructions, maybe even fewer, depending on the base machine you're in. But all of a sudden, you're doing a method call and checking for garbage and all that. It gets a good deal slower. So sometimes you give people too much power, and they give you some surprises. But this is a kind of a cool idea and something that you may see more about in future. The thing I was talking about earlier is that overloading exists and is good to some extent. The question is, how far do you want to carry it? And what happens is some languages, and Java to some extent, have allowed overloading in various contexts, and they disambiguate it by something called contextual resolution. Here's an example where the colors come through. Yeah, they sure did. Occasionally I use colors, not very much, so I'm like the Wizard of Oz. So now we're entering Oz, we're going from black and white to color. And in this case, notice that it's standard to use the identifier that represents a class name in two different ways. In this case, it's not much of a difference, so it's easy to kind of forget that there are really two different usages. Here, this is being used as a type name. It's a class, but classes are the way you define complex types in Java. So it says, of class C, create CVAR, just like I would int or char or bool. And over here, I'm calling it, and of course, I can't call a class name per se, but classes have constructors. And you can always tell a constructor because they got parens. And when I have a paren it's a situation that it's a constructor. We're going to find out it's even more complex than that. Has anybody who has ever learned Java tried to call a constructor a second time? Doesn't work. And you perhaps wondered why. As it turns out, the name of a constructor is not just the class name. It's a class name prefixed by new. And the new says really what it's that it's a constructor. And as I'll show you in a more complex example, next slide, you can actually have a method name C and a constructor name C that look the same with parens and arguments. And the way you tell them apart is by doing new. This is the old contextual resolution. That's the same thing we kind of do in human languages, where you try to figure out what somebody, when a word has multiple meanings, what the word means by the context in which it's used. And depending on how complex the language is, that is either difficult or easy. Yeah. No, no. What happens is the constructor has to go inside the class. But the only way this knows this is a constructor is by saying it's new. And then says, okay, go to that class and find the constructors. And inside them, they have the same name. But no, it doesn't go that far. But it turns out here, I guess I sliced it. But Java, that far, I'm willing to go with. I think this is perfectly fine. I think it's pretty easy to understand and so on. But Java decided to push contextual resolution a little further, saying, how much overloading do I want to have? I'm not going to have so much that the program definition is totally ambiguous. But they pushed it further than I think I'm comfortable with, and maybe you too. So in this case, I can have an identifier representing a class. We're happy with that. A class constructor. We're happy with that. Those are the two things here. But you can also have a package name. Don't use packages that much. Methods I use a lot, and fields. So let's look at this little combination of code where I use C in all kinds of interesting ways, particularly this last line here. So I have a class named C, no big deal there. I have a constructor named C, no big deal. But now in class D, I have a field named C. Okay? And I have a method of type double, a function actually, named C. And now I have 1, 2, 3, 4 calls, and by contextual resolution, aren't you glad you don't have this in your language, you have to figure out which of those four definitions means in each case. So in this case, I'm in the context of a type name. Of the sort of things I have, there's only one thing that's a type name, namely the class. So this must mean the class, excuse me, the class name C. I come here and I say new. Aha. The thing following a new is always a constructor. So this thing C must be the constructor for C. I then come inside here and I say, well, wait a minute. I'm inside of an expression. Type names are not allowed there. If I do a cast, remember, they got to be in parens. So it can't be a type name. It can't be a constructor because it doesn't have new. It can't be a method call because it doesn't have parens. So what's left? It's got to be a variable. So it's got to be in C. And I get to the fourth guy and say it's in the context of an expression, can't be a type name, doesn't have new in front of it, so it can't be a constructor. It's got parens around it, and that smells like a method, and sure enough, I have a method. So good old Java's able to figure out all four of those things by contextual resolution. Whether an ordinary user would be able to tell or not, I'm not so sure, and there's a case where I think you push it a little further. But all language designers have this issue, do we allow overloading? If so, how much? They call it contextual resolution, but it really is overloading. We have the same name sharing multiple definitions. And that means presumably inside here we have a lookup mechanism that's smart enough to say, just don't give me the definition of C. Give me the definitions of C, not all of which are equally local. Notice in this case, there's a local C inside this class, but there's also a definition of C outside that class that I normally won't look up until later. So I got to kind of say, tell me all the C's that you can see, small pun intended, and give me a list of them and I'll check them off. Yes, yes, no, yes. And if only one exists, I'm safe. So I would not necessarily like to be doing the semantic analyzer, the type checker for full Java. And, but that's what the language has decided. You don't have that level of complexity, but I just wanted to show you some of the ideas that get involved when you carry this further and further. Okay, now we're finally getting around to implementation issues. And here's something, by the way, where if you have this printed on paper, please do a little bit of a change. I've already done this on the master, but I haven't changed this. So remember we said more than a bit ago, that I wanted to make sure that strings were considered a kind, not a type. So in your notes, cross this out from the type and add it in when we get to the kind. So types are the basic values that may be manipulated in a language. And values we're going to consider are integer, representing the predefined int, boolean, representing the predefined bool, character, representing the predefined character, not string anymore. String's going to have a type of char because it's a conglomeration of characters. Void, where void means that it's in a spot where it could have a type but chose not to, namely a method. A couple of others that I'll add in that I'll suggest are useful are error. Error is where something should have a type, but because of some kind of error, you don't know the type. The reason that's useful is that you want to sort of have a garbage in, garbage out approach to type checking. If you don't know the type of something you're checking, creating additional error messages is problematic. A good example is you look up something and it's undeclared. Well, it ought to have a type, but it's undeclared. Now you're saying, okay, it's in the context of addition. So I have undeclared plus one. And I'm type checking this monster, assuming I can never get it focused. So I look up undeclared and say, hey, he's undeclared. I give an undeclared error message and talk about it. But now this thing is expected to give it a type. If I went ahead and tried to do further type checking, I might say, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to add something that's illegal. But you don't know it's illegal, you just know it was undeclared. When it's fixed up, then you can say whether it's valid or not. So giving a second error message doesn't give you any extra help. Until it's declared, it's garbage in. You can't talk about the validity of garbage. So a good trick is to, when something creates an error message and it has to generate a type, generate the type as error. And that says suppress any additional errors that might come up from further checking in this context. So if I didn't know the type of this guy, I can't say whether it's valid with plus, whether it's a valid parameter, whether it's valid to be read or written. And it may be the case that you want to differentiate error and unknown. Unknown would be as good initial value where you say, okay, I'm going to have to figure out what the type is, but I don't know what it is. So as soon as I figure out the type, it should be valid or error. But once I do type checking, it stops becoming unknown. So unknown is a good initial value. It's not error. It's not valid. It's in between. Just I don't know as yet. Kind is orthogonal. That is, I'll typically have a type and a kind associated with a particular identifier. And kind kind of says how the identifier is used independent of the actual values manipulated. So variables means I can read and write from it. We all know about variables. Value means that it's a value is computed and readable but not changeable. A name constant is a value. An expression like a plus b is a value. It's not a variable because I can't assign to A plus B, but it's a sort of situation there that it has a different kind of variable because the assignment is not possible, but it still is a value that can be used in a lot of contexts when a value is needed. I have an array where I have a group of values. I have a scalar parameter. Scalar simply means I have a single value. And it says it's by value. Forget about the by value for now. If you're knowledgeable about languages, it says how it's implemented. An array parameter says, I'm going to give you an array, not a scalar, but an array, but I don't know its size yet. I'll know that at the point of call. A method, a label, and now add stringlet in here as another possibility. So a method is something that's callable. A label, which I talked about, appears only on while loops, and then a stringlet, which is only usable in print statements, and to be assigned to a character array. And as I was saying, as we're going along, most combinations of type and kind make sense, which is why I consider them orthogonal. So for example, if I have type equals Boolean and kind equals value, that's a Boolean constant or expression. If I have type equal void and kind equal method, that's a procedure. That is a method that does not return a value. So when you're processing methods, we're going to have information on the method, but we're also going to have method information on the parameters. So the way we'll handle that, just to get a little bit ahead of ourselves, if I have a method, say m, of int a and bool array b. What's going to happen is, as I process this for type checking, that I'm going to create a symbol table entry for method, and I got to, let's say this is void. So I have an entry in a table that says I'm a method. That's my kind. And my type equals void. But because he's a method, we're going to have extra information about parameters. And in fact, a convenient way to do that is have a list of as many parameters, pairs, as you have parameters. And each pair will have, guess what? A type and a kind. So it says the first one is its type is int, and its kind is scalar parameter. So it's a scalar and an int. The second one is an array parameter. And it's a bool. So we'll know what the result type of the method is, and we'll also know in calling. Oops, thank you. And as it suggests on the slides here, that when you type check, you'll go ahead and, oh, it's still not very good, sorry. There we go. You'll have a list of those pairs, one for each parameter type, and that'll be useful when you get around to parameter checking. And here's an example, not quite the one I used here, that illustrated that. And what you'll do is when you see a call, so let's actually do a call here. So I see a call method of m of 1, comma, false. When we do the type checking, this will be a method call, a call note as it's denoted. And it'll say, okay, here's the name M. So I'm going to go look that up in the symbol table and say, oh yeah, there's a guy, M, he's kind as method, and he's being called as a statement. So his result type is void, fine so far. It's got some number of parameters. Let's count the parameters. I do that by counting the number of elements, 2. Look at my definition, 2. So the parameter count is fine. I then one by one say, this is an integer literal. So its type is int and its kind is value. So can a scalar parameter be a value? And the answer is yes, and int is int. Fine, first parameter is okay. Second parameter says false. False is a scalar Boolean. Is a scalar an array parameter? The answer is no. So I found a mismatch. The second parameter should be an array of Booleans. I gave it a single Boolean, and therefore at this point I would create an error message. And notice it can be a pretty good error message. Error at line so-and-so in method M, second parameter is an invalid kind. Or you can even spell it a little better. You know, that scalar provided, array expected, something of that sort. Exactly how you phrase that is up to you. But if you tell the user the line, the method, and the parameter number that's bad, you're fine. You've gone ahead and given that user more than enough information to fix things. So now we're finally getting around. These are actually spots where you're going to be implementing code. So what you probably want to do at some stage is print these out, and these can be the templates for actually implementing type checking. So what's going to happen here is we're going to have a visit method. Oh, next time we will. So let me just say that check these and subsequent ones, and these will be an outline of the steps you need to do in pretty good detail. So if, for example, you're type checking a var decl node, look at the steps, and these are the subtrees you'll have to access. Remember, next time is spring break, so you can be out sunning and funning, and 2 weeks from now, I'll be back and we'll be talking about this. Let me also say 2 weeks and a day from now is when we have our first midterm. So one of the things I'll do 2 weeks from today is have a review session in preparation for the exam, which will be held the next day. If you don't want to do the first exam, there's another one a week later, and you can take that one instead. And at least two people are taking an early exam because they got to be out of town doing sun and fun, I imagine.